A reading from the second book of Kings. At that time, the troops of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched on Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon himself, came to attack the city while his troops were besieging it. Then Jehoiakim, king of Judah, surrendered to the king of Babylon, he, his mother, his officers, his nobles, and his eunuchs, and the king of Babylon took them prisoner. This was in the 8th year of King Nebuchadnezzar. The latter carried off all the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace, and broke up all the golden furnishings that Solomon, king of Israel, had made for the sanctuary of the Lord, as the Lord had foretold. He carried off all Jerusalem into exile. All the nobles and all the notables, 10,000 of these, were exiled, with all the blacksmiths and metal workers. Only the poorest people in the country were left behind. And some verses now from Psalm 78. They've poured out blood like water in Jerusalem. No one is left to bury the dead. We have become the taunt of our neighbors, the mockery and scorn of those who surround us. How long, O Lord, will you be angry forever? How long will your anger burn like fire? O God, our Savior, come to our help. There is loveliness, a certain nobility even, about poetry. And I include here the ancient variety, those poems we call psalms. Nobility, loveliness. But the more we hear these psalms, the more we sing them in choir or chapel, the more we risk missing the cutting edge of the words, the tales of otherwise untold violence, of long-term desolation and biting self-pity, not to mention anger, of which God is accused. Will your anger burn like fire, and for how long? And I read an extract also from the second book of Kings, a text read in churches today. Here, more violence, the siege and overthrow of Jerusalem, the booty of war in the form of the temple's sacred vessels and the royal palace treasures, the deportation of a large percentage of the population of Jerusalem, the likely slaughter of many soldiers who sought to defend the holy city, and the likely squalid conditions in which the few survivors had to spend their remaining years. The Christian gospel is a tale of good news, but what I've said so far doesn't sound good at all. Perhaps only a few listeners are still with me, while others were so put off by my mention of violence that they switched off. Truth is, however, that the world into which the Son of God entered, to speak a world of peace, a word of reconciliation, and a path to glorious salvation, this was a world stained in blood. And he was born into a family whose history was not remarkable for its virtue. Just check the biography of many of those features in Matthew's attempt at a genealogy of Jesus. I believe that a great deal of the violence I have known, the violence I have seen and heard of, is closely linked with insecurity within, with fears that people just cannot cope with. And the accusation that God is angry is no more, in my view, than a prayerful, if reluctant, acceptance that anger is in the heart of him or her who lays the charge at God's door. What Jesus says, in a quotation churchgoers will hear today, is that foundations must be laid on solid rock. And if they are, then all the wind and storm this world can throw up will not destroy what has been built on solid foundations. Immature attempts at building, even at building our own lives, these will fail, and will fail spectacularly when the cold Arctic air of reality meets an ill-equipped defense. So where is the solid rock we can decide to build our lives on? Why, it is Christ's own teaching, a code of practice that sweeps away violence in words and actions of peace and peacemaking. Is anger gone then? By no means. Let's not be dreamers who ignore reality. But Christians are called to deal with anger, and at all costs to deal with it that very day, so that the sunset will not find us still angry. Have a peaceful day then, in the name of Christ.